From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. We've had streets full of protests in the last week since the election of Donald Trump, reports of harassment and hate crime. Washington Post reporter Wesley Lowery has been on the streets for more than 2 years now, since Ferguson, Missouri, and the Black Lives Matter movement blew up. In Ferguson, Baltimore, Charleston, Cleveland, now this country is moving from Obama to Trump, and he's still out there watching. This hour On Point, hate crimes, protest, race relations, and Black Lives Matter in the age of President Donald Trump. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you worried about rising rates of hate crime, racial rhetoric? Are you seeing it? What does the Black Lives Matter movement look like under a Trump presidency? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Wesley Lowery, criminal justice reporter at the Washington Post, watching street protests and people's movements before Trump's win and since. He shared a Pulitzer Prize this year for his work on a database of police killings. His new book is They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. The New York Times calls it electric. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Wes Lowery, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
You've been following protests for more than 2 years now, since it all swept up out of Ferguson, Missouri. In the last week, we've had a lot of protests as well, and reports of harassment and hate crimes. Are these different streams? Are they merging? What do you see unfolding here, Wesley?
They seem to be similar streams. You know, when we look at who has been taking the streets, and I've been working with some great colleagues at the Washington Post. We've had reporters in dozens of cities covering the backlash to the election of Donald Trump. And so as we've talked to various people who've taken the streets, what we often see is that these are people, one, who are demonstrating in places where arguably their vote for Hillary Clinton did not matter or would not have made a difference, right? Portland, Oregon, a deep blue state, or Boston, Massachusetts, a deep blue state, Chicago, Illinois, places where, you know, because our inclination very often to say, well, did you guys vote? Why is everyone so upset now? Well, and what we're seeing is some of the most spirited demonstrations and largest numbers of people in New York City, you know, are in places where, you know, these are certainly strongholds of the left, with voters who, you know, come from a varying group of, varying set of groups, whether that be people who might be affiliated with Black Lives Matter, people who might be immigration activists or LGBT activists, Muslims, like, and so it's going to be. It's already been quite a show of force in terms of people coming out into the streets, and I think it raises the question of what we will see in the coming months in terms of a vocal and physical opposition to the incoming presidential administration, something we haven't seen in decades.
Speaking of vocal and physical, what about the reports of harassment, hate crimes, or interactions leaning in that direction? Are you following that with the Post? And what about the surge that's been reported? Is it real? Do we know?
Well, and so the numbers that came out recently, it's difficult to completely comprehend because, like everything related to crime, we keep terribly insufficient statistics on things like hate crimes. For example, we just got an FBI report on hate crime rates for 2015, which is not particularly helpful to us in terms of gauging what's going on now. But what we have seen in terms of groups that follow this most closely is we have seen what people are describing as an uptick that rivals, if not surpasses, the uptick in hate crimes that we saw after 9/11. We certainly have seen anecdotally.
Do you mean now in the last week or do you mean before?
No, I mean since the election since the presidential election.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, while there certainly have been some cases of stories that have gone viral that seem to unravel with pressure, there certainly are cases and questions of people being harassed, of people being intimidated. And what is 100% true is that so many people, whether it be black and brown people, whether it be Muslims, whether it be women, have a real realized fear of what is to come. They feel besieged. They feel like they may be threatened or under attack. And that is something that it is something that is just extremely palatable, this anxiety among people who fear what is to come in the Donald Trump administration.
I want to get some of the sound of that in our ears as we think about what's going on here since Ferguson and now since the Trump election. You talked about demonstrations in blue states. Here was one in front of Los Angeles City Hall. This was the day after the election. Protesters cheering, chanting, "Not my president," while setting a Trump effigy on fire. But you can look in a different direction. Here, Houston, Texas. Houston Chronicle reporter Mark Mulligan covered a rally, University of Houston, on Monday. Here's a group of Donald Trump supporters chanting, "Build that wall.
Build that wall! Build that wall! Build that wall!
They're coming from all directions. On Sunday on CBS 60 Minutes, Leslie Stahl asked Donald Trump to address a rise in racial harassment, even hate crimes, since his victory.
They're harassing Latinos, Muslims.
I am so saddened to hear that, and I say stop it. If it helps, I will say this, and I'll say it right to the camera: stop it.
Wesley Lowery is with us. His new book is "They Can't Kill Us All: Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement." What's going to put a lid on what we've seen in the last week, Wesley? Are people just up? Are they upset just now because the election has just happened? It was shocking to many people, stunning to those who weren't Trump supporters, who perhaps did not see it coming. Or is there something built in here that takes it forward?
I don't know that this is something that's going to stop. And I think it also is something that's linked fundamentally to what we've seen happening in recent years. There hasn't been a time during the Obama presidency that there were not masses of people in the streets somewhere, whether that be the Tea Party and the rallies and the marches they were holding soon after President Obama's election, that gives way to Occupy Wall Street, a massive movement on the left. And eventually we see the rise of Black Lives Matter, which has been in the streets for, you know, 2 or 3 years now. And throughout all of that, you had other groups that were using acts of protest and demonstration and direct action to provide political pressure. So we saw disruptive protest by LGBT activists. We saw disruptive protest by immigration activists. And so in many ways, it's unsurprising when such a polarizing figure is victorious in our presidential election, someone who is so disliked by such a wide swath of the electorate. It's unsurprising that we're seeing a natural backlash to that from people who voted the other way and again, who feel fear or potentially threatened by what his candidacy promised and what his presidency might bring. What's fascinating also is that the clip you played is the only time, to my knowledge, that Donald Trump has in fact called for a stop to any violence or any attacks being done in his name or by his supporters. I mean, I think he sent, what, 5 or 6 tweets attacking the New York Times and not one asking his supporters to stop, you know, harassing Muslim women or beating up black people. And so there is a real question of what is the culpability and what is the responsibility when violence is being committed in the name of someone or intimidation or threats are being issued in the name of someone. What is the role of President-elect Trump in trying to quell this?
And of course, right at the base of this in your reporting, and you remind us quite rightly that there was a time, yes, it was the Tea Party in the streets and very much in the streets with sidearms and long weapons and all the rest in some circumstances. Since the election, Black Lives Matter protesters out as well. Here's the sound of a anti-Trump protest in New York's Union Square on the evening after the election. And this week, Monday night, three women who founded Black Lives Matter honored at Glamour Magazine's Women of the Year Awards. Here's one of those founders, Alicia Garza.
Black Lives Matter is more needed today than ever before. What happened in our country on Tuesday is something that we can fix. This is not the time for us to sit back and wonder what we're going to do. This is the time to build a movement in the millions.
We're going to look at exactly what may unfold with Black Lives Matter and much more in this time, new time of protest. Wesley Lowery is with us, author of They Can't Kill Us All. Cecilia is calling from Boston. Cecilia, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you so much. I just want to say that I am in so much fear. I have a knot in my stomach as I'm speaking with you. I am a woman. I am an immigrant. I have an accent. I'm brown. And I'm in complete fear. I have changed my Facebook name because my Facebook name had my complete name there. And I cannot believe I moved here. I am a single mother with 2 grown children that I moved to this country thinking it was a beacon of freedom.
Wesley, I think we lost. Are you there, Cecilia? Yep.
Yes, I'm here.
You moved here as a beacon of freedom, and now what?
Can you hear me?
Yes. And now what?
Yes. And now I don't know what... I am in fear. I'm in fear of speaking out. I'm in fear of... I was at the city hall with my father the other day. My father is 82 years old. He speaks Spanish. He speaks English, too, but he speaks Spanish to me.
Yeah.
And it's the first time that I had to tell, please do not speak Spanish, papi. Don't speak Spanish.
Has anything actually happened yet, Cecilia? I understand the fear, and we can hear it, but has anything actually really happened with you?
Yes. It happened to me at the gym. It happened to me at the gym when I was leaving the gym the other day.
Yeah, what?
And with a guy that had a humongous his car was full of Trump loggers, and he said something very racist to me.
Cecilia, I'm sorry for that. Hang in there. Be brave. We're talking about it. We'll see what unfolds. Wesley, you know, you hear the palpable feel in her voice. I'm a woman. I'm an immigrant. I'm brown. I have an accent and a knot in the stomach from fear.
It's hard not to tear up when you listen to accounts like that. And Cecilia, unfortunately, is so far from the first person who we've heard this from. I mean, my Twitter direct messages have been full of people saying to me, okay, keep doing this work. This is important. And also hear all the things I'm afraid of, my emails, the voicemails. We've seen and heard account after account. And I think that sometimes people, especially our white friends and our white fellow citizens, have a tendency to write off this fear that this is just unreasonable and there's no way Donald Trump's going to actually do all these terrible things. It's not like he's Hitler or anything, right? And that is not particularly comforting to people who have listened to rhetoric time and time again, constantly for 18 months, that seems to villainize them, to threaten them. When I talk to young black activists, young black people, the idea of a national stop and frisk is horrifying. The idea of a Muslim ban is horrifying. And I think that that's something that we can't disregard.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Washington Post reporter Wesley Lowery about hate crimes, harassment, protest, race relations, and now Black Lives Matter in the age of Donald Trump, president-elect. He's out with a new book. It records his reporting on the rise of Black Lives Matter from Ferguson, Missouri, and right forward. He was there, was arrested early on in the midst of the protest there in McDonald's as he was sitting and working on his reporting for the Washington Post. Kind of a famed incident, but much, much more has happened since then. And now here we are, a week after the election, protests in the streets, Trump people saying, come on, you know, we've got an election, we elected a president, let's try this. We're already hearing from callers, some saying, wait, I'm afraid. Where does this go? I guess there's lots of fronts we can look at this on, but Black Lives Matter, where does that go now in the age that Donald Trump has been elected? Is that now on the defensive or something else? What do you see coming? 800-423-8255. Here's a little tape of Wesley Lowery's arrest. He became a national name in August 2014 after that arrest at McDonald's in Ferguson. Went viral as a sign maybe of the police crackdown on protests there. Police saying, hey, off we go.
Grab your stuff. Let's go.
I'm working on it.
Stop videotaping. Let's grab our stuff and go.
I have some other right to videotape you, sir.
Hurry up. Let's go.
Please don't leave your gun at me.
Let's go.
You see me working on it.
Please don't wave your gun at me. And within seconds, he was cuffed and he was under arrest. Donald Trump, on a campaign trail, wasn't going with Black Lives Matter. He was interrupted at a rally in Radford, Virginia, by Black Lives Matter protesters. And here was his response.
All right, folks. You're going to hear it once. All lives matter. All lives matter.
And the Trump supporters there responding very vigorously to that. In August, on the campaign trail in Diamonddale, Michigan, he made his pitch to African-American voters, saying they've been so badly let down by President Obama and the Democratic Party policies that his administration was worth a try.
What do you have to lose? You're living in poverty. Your schools are no good. You have no jobs. 58% of your youth is unemployed. What the hell do you have to lose?
Wesley Lowery, answer those questions. What do you have to lose?
I mean, everything that at the time candidate Trump said was, these are just remarkably racist tropes, right? This idea that, come on, black people, it's not like you guys have jobs and you're riddled in crime and your lives are terrible. I mean, I couldn't make it any worse.
Come from Chicago. We did a show there last week. And of course, you know, they've got something like 40% in Chicago. They got something like 40% mm-hmm. youth unemployment among African-American young guys there. And, in Chicago, you've seen the gun death right there. It's not exactly Sesame Street.
No, certainly not. And I mean, I don't think anyone denies that there are issues, but none of these things are uniquely black issues, right? I think that there's history. We can't divorce current and current day rhetoric from historical context and understanding, right? Mm-hmm. We know that when white politicians in front of largely white audiences are parroting law and order talking points, talking about inner city crime, talking about lawlessness and joblessness, we know that those are essentially dog whistles, right? He was not actually appealing to black and brown voters, that rather he was talking to white suburban voters and convincing that because he's reflecting and projecting to them their own fears. That's why many of them left the cities that they once lived in and moved out away from the people of color, which is one of the reasons the jobs aren't in the cities anymore. I think that, I mean, it's very hard to make an argument that Donald Trump made any real good faith outreach to people of color. Now, he did receive votes from, you know, small portions of black voters and Hispanic voters, which is unsurprising, I think, because I think that no set of people are a monolith that way. But I do think that it raises this question of you had one party, the Democratic Party, that made real efforts to reach out to groups like Black Lives Matter or others and were critiqued for how they did that and how Hillary Clinton did that and Bernie Sanders tried to do that. Another group that essentially disavowed any need to build inroads with black and Hispanic communities. And I think that that's only going to further our political racial divide here moving forward. You have a candidate in Donald Trump who is supported by almost a statistically insignificant number of black people in the United States of America. That has never been the case in any elected president. President Trump was elected with the lowest amount of black people since black people got the unabridged right to vote in the 60s. And so I think it's going to be remarkable. And what are the potential consequences of that in terms of the divide that is driven?
Here's a little sound. This is a short clip, but maybe telling. This is from the Sunday before Election Day in Memphis, Tennessee. A white Trump supporter confronting a black driver in Memphis, Tennessee, in a parking lot there.
Trump, all the way. Trump. Because black lives don't matter. There ain't no proof. Just because you say something don't mean nothing.
Just a little clip of a little bit of what's going on in America these days. John in Statesville, North Carolina. John, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, yes, sir. I just wanted to see, ask a question, basically, why the left side rhetoric is actually drumming up the fear to actually push against a Trump presidency when actually you see more hatred against the conservative right side and with religious freedom, and also some of the attacks that you've seen on video where Trump supporters getting pulled out of a car and getting beaten. That's not getting any media publicity. So I guess my fear is if our country's going to move forward, that we can't fight against basically some of the conservative values that has led this country to greatness, including religious freedom, by drumming up fear on the left side just to get the African-American vote out in the past and to drum some of the hatred toward Trump is not going to move our country forward. So basically, I guess to unite our country once again, if they keep this rhetoric up, it's just going to divide our country against foreign adversaries that might be willing to attack us.
John, I hear you. I must say I did see the when the Trump supporter was pulled out of the car, that got very widespread coverage. I saw it as the lead story on national television that night. And yes, there's a lot of talk now, and we've played a bunch of it right here, against Trump in the streets. What about the other rhetoric, John? What about the rhetoric that makes some substantial number of people in this country feel themselves fearful, with drummed up or not, you know, all on their own? You heard our first caller. I don't think that's because she's listening to the radio. Are you there, John?
Yes. And I think basically what eventually is going to have to do is follow the money trail to see who promoted some of the riots and Black Lives Matter and some of the protests are going on in these states right now to see where the money's coming from to initiate these protests and cause the fear mongering in our country to cause division. And that ultimately they should pay a price for a crime for doing that. If there's any riots and damage to property owners, whoever's paying these protesters to come out and do
John,
that.
John, we got the perspective. Let's go to the reporter and the reporting. Wesley, this has been out there in the last week, people saying, Donald Trump said these are professionals who were driving the protests in the streets around the country. This is your beat. What do you say? Is that true?
No. I think that sometimes we want to. I think we're often much more comfortable when we believe things are calm, right? Protest, and part of the point of protest is to upset people, to inconvenience people, to create chaos, right? To rattle a system. But when you see in the days after an election, thousands of people, hundreds of people, those people aren't all getting paychecks, right? The young college students in the city of Portland or New York aren't getting paid in some weird George Soros conspiracy. Like that's not – and that was not true. That was not true of Occupy Wall Street. That was not true of it was not true of Black Lives Matter. This idea that somehow this is all just a big conspiracy, that there's no legitimate fear at all, the media has made all this up. I mean, it's something that I think is a lot easier to scapegoat than is to grapple with the idea of, wait, are some of our fellow citizens this upset and this rattled? In the book, I write about young activists and young people who were not being paid. They were not coming out even meaning to be protesters, but they saw someone being killed in the street and they said, this is I can't deal with this. I don't want this to happen. I want to live in a different America. Ferguson in Baltimore, mm-hmm. and Cleveland and Charleston. Bree Newsom, who took the Confederate flag down in South Carolina, she wasn't a paid protester. She was a woman who had strong convictions and she believed in action in the face of fear. And I think that it's too dismissive sometimes when we just assume, well, these are just all paid protesters. This is just the riffraff. Who cares what they think? These are thousands, tens of thousands of our fellow Americans. And the other thing is, I think that we have to I think the last caller raised points that a lot of people raise. But I think sometimes we have to interrogate those a little bit, right? We need to unite again. When exactly was our nation united? When was this? At what point in time do we want to point to that we need to get back to? And also, and that
what are you getting at with
country,
that? What are you getting at with that? You're saying?
Well, I'm getting that we romanticize a history that never existed. When was America great for every American citizen? When was that? Exactly, right? When were
There's
we
There's certainly
united?
A time when America has been great, but you're sort of...
Meaning what? Great for who?
Well, I mean, when it was a great power, certainly. But you're focusing more tightly here and saying, well, yes, but down in the grain of that great power, there was racial inequality, extreme racial inequality.
Well, exactly, right? And we're still a great power, right? If that's the standard for greatness, then America's still great. If that's what we mean, right? Mm-hmm. But when I think of a great nation, I think of a nation that is great to the people who make up the nation. And I don't, like I said, I would challenge anyone who thinks that there's something we need to return to provide an exact date and time that we should rewind to. Because if we go back far enough, our gay brothers and sisters won't be able to get married. If we go back a little further than that, our mothers and sisters won't be able to vote. If we go a little farther than that, I won't be able to vote and I won't be able to get an education. I can't go to school and I got to pick which water fountains I drink
from. As an African-American man.
Correct, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that sometimes we reflexively and instinctively default to this idea that somehow this was – at some time we were less divided. And I just don't know at what point in our history, especially around issues of race, we were ever united other than when the powers that be all united to enslave millions of people.
David in Atlanta, Georgia. David, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I just wanted to say that as a white man in the South – I see the kinds of things that your guest is talking about and that some of the other callers have been talking about. I am definitely on the left side of the spectrum politically, but being a white male, I tend to be, seen as like a safe person to speak about racism, to be racist. I have employers who make jokes that, now everything's not going to be free anymore, now that Trump's in. We're not just going to be giving everything away anymore. Or, you know, I have seen postal workers, you know, just as I was talking with a customer the other day, stopped in, and he was so excited that Trump had won. He said, yeah, finally, a real redneck in power. You know, and it's just assumed that because I'm white, it's okay to say that kind of thing. But I feel that same fear that your caller was expressing. I was choking back tears just listening to her. I feel that fear for my daughter. I feel that fear for all of my friends of color, my LGBTQ friends, who I know are, you know, worried for their safety and who already experience racism and sexism during the Obama administration. And now the difference is that we have a president who glorifies those things, who says those things are okay, who says, you know, who writes all those things off. I'm really shudder to think what's going to be next, you know. So I am enthusiastically trying to figure out ways to empower my friends of color, my friends who are LGBTQ, to help swing this social and political pendulum back the other way and make sure that those people are safe and listened to.
David, we've got it. I mean, let us note again that Donald Trump said on Sunday on 60 Minutes, stop it, to those who are out harassing. But there, of course, have been a lot of things said. Wes Lowery, let me ask you about Black Lives Matter now. I mean, I see this statement that has just come out in the last day, I think. National leaders of the Black Lives Matter Global Network talking about their mandate being unchanged after, and I'm quoting from their statement here, they said, after the election, quoting here, the election of a white supremacist to the highest office in American government. They say, we ask ourselves, how do we reconcile our vision for future generations' prosperity with the knowledge that more than a half of white voting Americans believe a white supremacist can and should decide what's best for this country? Their answer, they say, and I'm quoting from them here, is we organize. What's coming? What's the plan, Wesley?
You know, I have been interviewing and talking with a lot of activists, both just running into some of them since the election and also, you know, in terms of interviews. And I would never posture as to speak for them. But what I say is – what I would say is that, you know, having talked to a lot of folks, there are certainly things coming, right? There's certainly – I definitely think we will see direct actions. I think we'll see protests. I think we'll see people in the streets. But I also think we're going to continue to see complex and high-level efforts and campaigns to attempt to counteract and aggressively stop some of the vowed policies and steps that Donald Trump has said he's going to take.
Like now, what? What do you mean there?
Well, so for example, in the policing space, one thing that I write about a lot in the book and cover a lot is issues of policing and potential police reforms. One thing that my colleagues and I did at the Washington Post is we built a database to try to track all the fatal police shootings. And because of that project, and is a similar project that the Guardian newspaper did, the Department of Justice announced they were going to track, they were going to keep federal stats on this. Donald Trump has the power to undo that. He doesn't have to keep that promise. He has the power to undo every local police reform.
To say, do not keep statistics on murders killings, I should say.
On people who are killed by the police. And Donald Trump has said before that the federal government should not be demanding this information from local police departments, which is a 180 from what from the ethos and the ideology of the Obama administration, which is, of course, local police departments should be providing information about who they are killing to the federal government. Donald Trump – and that's just a small sliver of – what the possibilities of what could happen in the justice space. These consent decrees. We've read the Ferguson report or the Baltimore report, Cleveland. They're investigating Chicago currently.
Federal Donald Trump, government requiring them to sort of change and reform their policing.
Yes. Donald Trump can not only stop doing those investigations, he can undo the current consent decrees that already exist. And so he is empowered through his attorney general and his Department of Justice to erase 8 years of gains by these activists, by these demonstrators, and by the Department of Justice. That's something that I think that people are going to be actively campaigning and fighting against to try to show him through both their physical presence as well as political pressure that this is something that's important. Because those, like I said, you've got departments now that are in year two or year three of federally mandated reforms that with a snap of the fingers, those could be gone.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Blue Apron. providing pre-portioned, fresh ingredients with easy recipes delivered to your door. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with free shipping at blueapron.com/onpoint. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Washington Post reporter Wesley Lowery about hate crimes, protest, race relations now, and Black Lives Matter in the age of President-elect and soon-to-be President Donald Trump. He's followed the Black Lives Matter movement ever since Ferguson, Missouri, was there from the very beginning, right across this country. He's out with a new book called They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. You can join us this hour. Where do race relations go in this country under President Trump? Today in Athens, Greece, President Obama traveling, of course, and he spoke out against a mood of racial division. Here was the president.
In the United States, we know what happens when we start dividing ourselves along lines of race or religion or ethnicity. It's dangerous. Not just for the minority groups that are subjected to that kind of discrimination, or in some cases in the past, violence, but because we then don't realize our potential as a country.
President Obama, that was yesterday in Athens, Greece. Wesley Lowery is with us from New York. Audrey's calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Audrey, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom. I guess what I find most disturbing about all of this is the willful ignorance that I see in my fellow Americans. I heard your caller called in, and he wants to believe that these anti-Trump protests are organized and populated by paid protesters. I assure you that is not the case. I have many friends and their college-age children who have protested in Miami and Los Angeles, both places I used to live. And also people who are saying that this increase in hate crimes or increase in indecency and racism is it's not real. I assure you that it is. My husband, who happens to be Brazilian and who is only here because I wanted to move back to the States, 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
A few days ago after the election, he was told by the husband of a woman he used to work with to, quote, go back where he came from. He's an engineer with an MBA.
By a fellow worker, he was told that? By a co-worker?
An ex-worker.
Okay.
And this a woman, an ex-colleague, her husband. And you know what the biggest irony is?
Mm.
They're Cuban Americans. They're children of refugees. And what I find most frustrating is what I've seen on Facebook, and this isn't just from people I know who voted for Trump. It's also friends who voted for Clinton. But I have to tell you that they are white, and so they're not necessarily targets of the racism and xenophobia that man has been spreading over the past several months. These calls to give Trump a chance and to, quiet down and to quit whining. I didn't really know what to do in the days after the election because I was in such shock until I finally realized that the message that needs to go out there and the message that I personally want to spread is say what you need to say. Do not let anyone shame you into silence. If you have been the victim of indecency, say it. And say it with respect and say it as kindly as you possibly can, because otherwise you're going to shut down the conversation. But say it. Don't let people close their eyes to this. We're better than this.
Audrey, I appreciate your call. Let me get a couple more here, Wesley, and I'll bring it to you. Gina in East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Audrey, thank you very much in Atlanta. Gina, you're on.
Hello. Hi, Tom. Hi, Leslie. I went to my first protest on Saturday in New York City with my college-age daughter, who is 19. She wanted to go to a protest. I said, well, I'm coming down to visit you, so instead of lunch, we'll go to a protest. We were at the right by Trump Tower. We could look up onto the tower and see the security forces look down on us. So we were in the first block. We had no idea it went on for 40 blocks. And I have to tell you, I didn't see one professional protester. All the signs were made on flattened boxes and pieces of cardboard. And there were people of all ages there. I'm 53, a mother of three. And the two women in front of me walked over from their Park Avenue apartment to protest, and they were dressed very beautifully, but there was also plenty of college students and elderly people and people with children as well. So for those people who think this is professionally staffed, it is not. It's very organic.
What were you trying to say with your presence there, or what was your daughter trying to say, Gina?
My daughter feels that women's rights, especially the reproductive rights, are going to be pushed back in the Trump administration. I am concerned about opening federal lands for use for fracking, for oil drilling, and for coal mining. I think that's really a backward push. And there were people there with all different issues, and I think the biggest was people were afraid that minorities in this country and illegal immigrants and recent immigrants are going to be frightened and pushed to the periphery of society or even pushed out of our country in all cases. I think everyone had that as their first issue, and then they had personal issues following that as well.
Gina, I've got it. And there you were, 53, and at a rally in New York. First, sounds like maybe the first one in your life. One more call, and I'll come to you, Wes. Jim in Charlotte, North Carolina. Jim, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I just, you know, basically I want to start off with saying that, you know, I really want to see our country come together. I wasn't a fan of either candidate. And these protests that are happening, I understand people are frustrated. I don't know if it's the best thing to do. I mean, but getting our word out is a great thing. I just want to remind people that, you know, our presidency, it doesn't matter whether you go back to the first president or you jump up in timelines. You know, I remember talking to my aunt, and she said that when Kennedy won, she said, you know, oh, my gosh, everybody was panicking, and my grandfather was panicking because he thought that the church was going to take over the government. You go back just 8 years ago when President Obama won. And, of course, all the far-right people were going absolutely ballistic that, oh, my gosh, our country is going to go under, blah, 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 this is going to happen. You know, with what Trump wants to do, I don't agree with all of it, believe me. But the thing is, we as Americans need to come together and work on this and work together to get our country to move forward, not sit there and protest and stop things, stop traffic. You know, disorganized things, it makes it a lot more difficult for anything to happen and for us to come together as a country and be good again.
Jim, I appreciate your call very much. Wes Lowry, there's three in a row, two, you know, ready to protest, out protesting, and Jim saying, come on, let's get united here. You talk a lot with Black Lives Matter. You see what's going on with the protests. What's the way forward that deals, can we deal with everybody's concerns here and unite in a new way? Is that just not in the cards?
I just, you know, like I said, I'm not particularly an optimist on this because I just don't believe that we've ever been united, right? This is some ideal that we're chasing that is non-existent.
Shouldn't we try? I mean, it is one country, and I don't mean a unity that papers over problems.
I mean, so how do we do that if we don't want to hear from people about what their problems are?
Well, I don't mind hearing. It's a talk show right here. I'm happy to hear.
You know, but that's what I mean, though, right? Because that language is a means of dressing up. You know, I don't want people in the streets protesting. It's disruptive. Why can't we all just come together and get along? It's like, well, no, because, I mean, remember our caller 20 minutes ago who was crying on the phone?
Yes,
I want to tell her, get out of the streets. Why don't we come together? I want to hug her and figure out how we can build a world where she doesn't have to be so scared to be who she is, mm-hmm. right? And I think the only way we can do that is by validating and hearing her fears, right? I think that one thing that was written after Black Lives Matter began building some momentum was I remember someone writing, a conservative writer, coming to this conclusion. This is after the third or fourth city where there had been protests. And he said, I've reached the point where I can no longer believe that everyone in the streets is lying, right? That if 1,000 people are there and they're saying the police have treated me this way and I'm scared and I – that – I can't believe that all of them are just these paid protesters, these race-hustling charlatans. Everyone's doing this for a paycheck. No one really cares, or it's all a liberal conspiracy, right? That, like, how many people, how many black and brown people, how many women, how many LGBT people have to tell us about their fears and about their worries before we decide we want to believe them? And that – because, again, I don't know how we can come together unless that coming together means validating and hearing the voices of people whose voices have historically been – oppressed and muted.
Well, let me ask you, if I may, there's been a lot of talk about President-elect Trump right now because he's just won the vote. But during all the time you're writing about in this book, it was President Barack Obama. And, of course, he had been president for some years before Ferguson. And at one point in the book, you write, the headlines of the Obama years often seemed a yearbook of black death, raising a morbid and depressing quandary for black men and women. Why had the promise and potential of such a transformative presidency not yet reached down to the lives of those who elected him? How do you read this Black Lives Movement rising under the first black president, historic President Barack Obama?
You know, I think that the writer and friend of mine, Jelani Cobb, said this once, that we needed to have a black president so we could understand the limitations of a black president. We projected onto the president the responsibility for uniting us and bringing us together the way that now all of our callers are saying that we must and we need to. If we remember, President Obama in his DNC speech, when he was the candidate Obama at the time, talked about how, you know, we're not a collection. It's not black America and white America and Hispanic America, but a United States of America. On his election night speech in 2008, he says, we're not red states and blue states, but rather we're United States, right? His entire ideology was about this, transcending, the lowest common denominator politics that we often fall into, and rather aspiring to come together in this way. What the presidency of Barack Obama showed us is how deep those divides are that we are attempting to bridge, right? That his very legitimacy as a president was questioned from the beginning and throughout, and that eventually we, in fact, end up electing someone who is the literal opposite of Barack Obama in every way, right? Whether that be in race, in temperament, in his ability to articulate policy and ideas, and also in the belief of what is American exceptionalism, right? Barack Obama's idea of American exceptionalism, as outlined in his speeches and in his policies, is one that says America is great and is exceptional because we have the ability to keep getting better. We can be better tomorrow than we are today. Donald Trump's idea of American exceptionalism, as outlined in his speeches and in his Make America Great Again, is that we had a greatness once that we lost and we must return to it. I just think that we can't overlook how there's been such a divide in these spaces. Now, why does that lead to the rise of Black Lives Matter or Occupy Wall Street or any of the protest movements we've seen? Because people, you know, many of the activists I talk about in this book came into politics through Barack Obama. They voted possibly for the first time for him in 2008 or 2012. These are 20-somethings, right? Many of them canvassed for Barack Obama. They believed. They fired up and ready to go. Change we can believe in. And then they saw that simply having a black man in the White House was not enough, right? They saw that Trayvon Martin was still dead and the man who killed him didn't go to jail for it. They saw that Michael Brown was still dead. I'll never forget a town hall that now has even more significance. It was moderated by Gwen Ifill right after Ferguson. And I remember she had Tef Poe, who was a local activist and hip-hop artist in St. Louis, and in a conversation with Claire McCaskill, the senator in Missouri. And Claire McCaskill kind of falls into what we hear very typically when activists or people go into the streets. Well, you need to register to vote and you need to call your representative and you need the very traditional engage in politics.
Take it to the ballot box.
And he looks at her and he says, I voted for Barack Obama twice and Michael Brown is still dead. And I think that captures the ethos of this politics, this idea that we often set up a false binary. Either you are in the streets or you are engaged in the political process through voting. And we forget that protest is the most fundamental means of participating in democracy.
Of course, African-Americans voted in just about the same portion that white Americans voted in this.
Of course. And that's been consistently the case the last few elections, right? And it's not – but again, I think that we have an inclination, especially those of us who ourselves don't protest, who are more elite, in, you know, we're the media or we're political operatives, or why are these people yelling in the streets? Why don't they just, you know, and I think that we can be too reflexively dismissive of activism and protesting. Because again, protest is power. It creates community. It creates common bonds. It lets you find that yourself not being alone, that you are a Hispanic woman, you are a Muslim woman, you are a black man, and now you are in the street with other people like you. And so that fear is no longer so singular.
Three things I want to note here. One is I've got, you know, callers here I just don't have time to get to, saying, hey, I voted for Trump and I'm not racist. We've got here the officer who shot and killed Philando Castile was just charged this morning with second-degree manslaughter in Minnesota, the finding there that deadly force was not justified in that famous case. And then CNN's reporting that former Arizona Governor Jan Brewer has said this morning that the protests are orchestrated, that people who fly the Mexican flag are showing their allegiance to Mexico, not the U.S., and, of course, she is on some cabinet shortlist, possibly to be Secretary of Interior, Wes.
I think one thing that's been interesting, and we'll never solve it, we'd have to do 9 more shows before we could ever get all the way to the bottom of it. But I think one thing that's been very interesting has been this conversation about the role of racism in this election, what it means, and how do you grapple with people who insist that there's no way I'm a racist. I'm not racist at all. I've got black friends. I voted for Barack Obama once, right? Who willingly vote for someone who has avowed policies that would have that would be racially disparate, some of which are objectively racist, a Muslim ban, nationwide stop and frisk. And how do you reconcile that then, right? This is both people who affirmatively voted for Donald Trump as well as people who were so unmoved by the potential racism of the Trump administration that they did not vote, right? And so I think that there's a real question. I think very often we have this debate because in many circles, there's nothing worse you can be called than a racist, right? That it's the worst possible sin. And so there's this deep entrenched idea that we have to fight back against it. But what we know is that we all possess prejudice. We all possess the capacity for racism. And the sooner we can admit that, the sooner we can start addressing this more broadly.
Eyes Wide Open on lots of sides right now. Wesley Lowery's new book is They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. Joined us today from New York, national reporter covering law enforcement and justice for The Washington Post. Wes, good luck. Keep reporting. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Anytime, Tom. Thanks so much.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.